We hear a lot of perspectives on the Mankind podcast. Inclusion of a guest is not an endorsement of their views, and the opinions expressed here do not always represent the mission or values of the Mankind Project USA.
Looks like the rain has gone.
Hey, everybody, it's Boysen Hodgson. Welcome back to the Mankind Podcast, the podcast where we set out to prove, and I think do a fine job of proving, that there's more than one way to be a man. We are complicating masculinity over and over and over and bringing some rich conversations out. Today, a man that I have not known personally, but known of for as long as I've been in men's work, since very early in men's work, Rick Belden. And Rick, say hello first.
Hello, Boysen. Hello, everybody who's watching or listening.
I have known about Rick, as I said, since probably the mid-2000s. Mm-hmm. And he's been at this game for a very long time. He is an artist, a poet, and a coach who works with men to solve difficult emotional, personal, and relational challenges. So, you know, this is kind of from his presentation. If you're a man feeling stuck in a life that's inauthentic, unfulfilling, or stagnant, Rick helps men get things moving again. His primary focus is on repatterning relationships men have with themselves, as that relationship is the fundamental driver that determines the quality and outcomes of their decisions, behaviors, and lives. He's been through a lot in his life. We'll probably dig into some of that. And he has a message of hope. And in our pre-conversation, we got onto a conversation and just said, so what are we going to talk about? And within 15 minutes, we had at least 15 bullet points of different things that we could dive into. So, Rick, I'm looking forward to the conversation today. And I'm going to set us up that we're going to be talking about the mother wound. We're going to be talking about maturity. We're going to be talking about healing in relationships. We're going to be talking about adolescence as well. So stick with us for that. So the first thing I'm going to say, this is a note that I took in our previous meeting. You said maturity is a matter of levels, not a switch that you flip. I want to start there. Okay. Let's talk about maturity and growth. What do you see in your practice of coaching?
What do I see in terms of the process, or what do I see in terms of where a lot of men are?
Where a lot of men are, where that flip the switch thing, I think, was my expectation, right? It's like, I'm going to flip the switch and be fixed stuff. And I think right. That where we were in our conversation was, it just isn't that way.
No, and I'll just start off by saying that 2023 was a major experience in moving into adulthood for me. I was 65 in 2023, and I thought I was all grown up, and I had some stressors and some catastrophes in my life that forced me to look at myself. And I look back on who I was a year ago or 2 years ago now, and it's just like I was still operating in some ways that were very childlike. To my detriment, we don't want to completely crush and squeeze out those aspects of ourselves from earlier ages, which we'll be talking about later probably. But I can look at my decision-making process. I can look at the kind of magical thinking that I was doing on a regular basis. I can, particularly in my relationships and my expectations of other people, I was not realistic about other people's capabilities. And I was still trying to cajole and manipulate and overfunction my way into getting people to meet my needs, which is something that a child who's in a situation with unmet needs learns to do, because what choice do you have? But it's not appropriate for a man who's 65, and it doesn't turn out well. And that's not to be critical of myself. It goes to the point of the question, which is that maturity is a developmental process. And you have to go through developmental stages in the direction of maturity rather than a switch that turns on and off, or just suddenly one day you wake up and it's like, oh, I'm mature now. It's like, well, we have so many embedded, conditioned patterns of thought, belief, perception, and they get in the way. So if we're still operating out of a set of narratives and assumptions that we adapted or were conditioned into when we were growing up, it doesn't matter if you're 65, it doesn't matter if you're 45, it doesn't matter if you're 85, you're still not fully mature in terms of the potential that you have and how you function, how you perceive, how you operate, how you make decisions. And it shows up in your relationships with other people as it did in mine.
Can I go to the personal level of what was it that kind of finally woke you up last year to this new set of things? What was it that triggered it?
Two things in parallel, actually, which was horrible. But actually, sometimes if you want to grow, it's like, well, you might as well turn up the dial. But yeah, I had a 5-year romantic relationship that crashed in a very catastrophic way for me. That was very shocking, and really it re-traumatized me in a lot of ways, and it connected with some things that we're going to talk about later that I hadn't fully completed that I thought I had. And at the same time, my relationship with my closest sibling also crashed in parallel with that. And so then that caused me to, it forced me to look at the family system that I came out of. And to, again, I still had some fantasies about what those relationships and what that family system could be like from when I was a little boy. I didn't know that I had them. If you know that you have these things, you pretty much flush it out. But if you're operating with that sort of information under your level of awareness, in my case, I'll just say I was getting frustrated a lot. I was disappointed a lot. I was wearing myself out trying to get things to work that weren't working. And so, yeah, it was two of my closest relationships that actually just hit the wall and fell apart roughly at the same time. And so, yeah, that backed me into a corner and says, okay, well, I got to look at myself here. And it took a year of that and it was a lot of hard work too, but I needed to do it because this is what happens when you talk about men who come to me. A lot of the men who come to me are like, I'm tired of this. I'm tired of getting the same lousy result. I don't know what to do because I don't understand why it keeps happening. And that's an invitation to look at your level of operational maturity, I'll say, and kind of start, you know, try to get some distance from, one of the things I say to clients all the time is like, if you can separate and segregate the emotional energy from the information, then you can look at the information and you can typically take some action based on the information. It doesn't mean the emotions don't matter. It just means that the emotions can be so intense because, again, they travel all the way back in time to when you were younger that you can't see the information, even though you keep getting slapped upside the head with it over and over and over again. It's the pain of the experience that we tend to focus on rather than the information that is encapsulated in the experience.
That's really well said. Yes. Calls out to me something that I have heard in my own therapy over time. My therapist said this. I turned 53 next week.
Congratulations on getting this far.
Right. Yeah, there we go. Yay. And my therapist said something in a single sentence that was like revolutionary to me. Why didn't I think of this before? Our brains are time machines. Our brains do not exist in the present moment. Our brains exist then and now and out there in the future, all at the same time. We're constantly running that. So there's no like, oh, well, that happened to me 40 years ago. Why am I still thinking about today? My brain doesn't know that.
Well, and I'll kind of back that up with a quote that I like to use all the time, from a gentleman named John Sarno, who said the reason childhood things matter is because the unconscious has no sense of time.
What is it like to be, having been working with men for so long, are there things that you see men experience? You just kind of spoke to it, right? I'm frustrated. The triggers that finally get men to wake up to things. So for listeners out there, is there anything that you could say, like, if you're noticing this, if you're noticing this, if you're noticing this, maybe this means you're ready for another level of work?
Well, one of the first things that comes to mind is if you find that you're applying an enormous amount of effort and focused energy in a situation and you're getting nowhere, or you feel like you're going backwards, that's often a pretty good signal, particularly if it's a repeated pattern. Another one I think I alluded to earlier is, you know, if you've been divorced two or three times and your current relationship seems to be going in the same direction, that's a pretty good prompt right there. And sometimes it's health issues where you can't seem to get over the hump in trying to get in shape, or you're starting to notice that you don't feel like doing anything anymore and you've had all your medical checkups and everything's fine, but you don't feel motivated. That's a big one, I think, is basically that tells to me that suggests that the narrative that you've been running with for a long time just doesn't work anymore. And so it's time to examine it. And, you know, a lot of what I want to work with men, and, you know, I do some work with women too, but primarily with men, is like, what is motivating your choices? What is motivating your actions? What are you expecting that you're going to receive by doing this? Do you even know? And that's another one, is like, if you're doing a bunch of stuff and you don't even know why anymore, it used to make sense, but now it doesn't. That's another entry point.
Nice. And I want to start going back. So you and I talked about inner child work when we last met. And one of the things that you brought to the fore was that one of the oft overlooked pieces of inner child work is adolescence.
Yes.
And adolescent work. So let's talk about working with men and the adolescent in all of us.
And the pre-adolescent.
And the pre-adolescent. As well. Yeah. So expand on that. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, most commonly when you hear people talking about looking into themselves to make a connection with who they were when they were younger, typically you hear about inner child. And when people think inner child, they think 3-year-old, 5-year-old, 6-year-old, 7-year-old, maybe 8-year-old. And there's a lot of focus on that. But when you think about a 12-year-old, a 13-year-old, a 14-year-old, a 15-year-old, a lot of people don't want to mess with that. Because children are like, oh, they're fun, and I can just tell him what to do. Whereas you start getting into 12, 13, 14, 15, it's just like, those kids are scary, man. They're unruly. They're not quite sure who they are. And so I know in my case, I did all the inner child work, and it seemed to go well. It is still, well, there was a lot of trauma in my life at that age, so it wasn't always easy to approach. But what I started to notice was, if I was around kids who were 13, 14, 15 years old, I was very uncomfortable. Like, I didn't really want to be around them. And for the longest time, and then when they get to be about 16 or 17, it's like, no, they're okay, you know? And I for the longest time, I couldn't understand it. And then I started kind of reflecting back on what was going on in my life at 12, 13, 14, and 15. And number one, there's like you kind of cross the Rubicon at some point, and you're not a kid anymore somewhere in that area. Yeah. Some people have to cross that boundary a lot earlier because of the childhood, home, family situations that they're in just don't allow them to be children as long as they should be able to. But the point is that I started looking at what was going on at that point in my life, and I realized this, oh my God, man, this was a super traumatic time in my life from inside and from outside. And then I started noticing that if I look at photos of myself at 12 or 13 or 14, I'm like, I don't really relate to that. Mm-hmm. I don't really recognize myself. I recognize it because I know factually that's me, but I couldn't make a good connection with that part of myself, and started realizing that I wasn't sure I wanted to, because I didn't trust him and he didn't trust me. And so that's one of the things that I do, you know, that we talked about before with clients, is I want to help them connect to the 6 or 7 year old. And I have ways to do that. but I also want to help them connect to the 12, 13, 14, 15 year old, because a lot of men that I work with, I'll ask them to share some photos with me at different ages. And typically when they look at the little guy, yeah, I'll say, do you feel like this is you? And they'll say, yeah. You know, they don't necessarily feel, yeah, comfortable or whatever. But a lot of the time if they show me a photo of themselves at 13, 14, 15, I'll say, do you feel like this is you? And they'll say, nope, I don't like him. He's a big nerd. He was clumsy. He never got picked on the team. He was stupid around girls. You know, so that just tells me, it's like, okay, there's a ruptured connection there with a part of yourself, that you identify with that age and that look. And it's a hard time for a lot of boys. If you're not kind of like top of the line, you know, athletic,
yep,
good looking, confident, tall, it's rough. And even for those guys, it's rough, because a lot of those, yeah, guys are just putting out an act because they don't know what they're doing either.
None of us did, right?
Right. Yeah.
We didn't. And I think the word that you used before was, many men experience, and I so resonate with this, a sense of revulsion from,
yes,
from that me. From that, and, yeah, and I also, the recognition as I've done my work around it, is that that's when the kind of hardcore coping mechanisms kicked in.
Right. Like, right.
Stuff, right, that, so I'm ashamed of now, right? The hardcore stuff. Yeah.
Right. And the biggest thing that I'm ashamed of is that I just cut part of myself off. Because I didn't even know it at the time, because nobody talked about this, but I had an eating disorder. I was very thin. But nobody talked about that. Even in girls at that time, nobody was talking about those things. So I was very skinny and people made fun of me. And I wasn't hip to, like the latest styles and stuff. So I had my haircut wasn't really up to snuff, and I was very smart. So I got called a nerd and all this stuff, and I just got tortured by bullies and everything. And I just reached a certain point where I just decided, I'm going to become a different person who's not going to be targeted like this. Mm. And so I left that part of myself behind, and I felt a lot of shame around him. So if I looked at photos of myself, if I looked at my freshman high school yearbook photo, I would just feel humiliated, just to look at him. And I just felt like I don't want to be connected to him. He was the subject of all the abuse. He was the target of all the bullying. He was the one who didn't know how to fit in. And so I, for my own survival, I figured out how to leave him, how to cut him out and morph into somebody who would fit in, who had more of a rebellious attitude and the long hair and the mustache, as opposed to the, you know, the short hair and, you know, wisecracking class, smoking dope, you know. And the thing is, I still really like that guy.
Yeah.
I do, because it was the first time voicing in my life that I was actually establishing an identity that I had decided on for myself. And it was the first time I felt like I had any autonomy at all. And he had an attitude, and it was like, oh, wow, that guy's kind of cool. That other guy before him, I don't want to deal with that guy. And it's still tough to approach it because my motivation for changing into a different persona was a feeling of shame and humiliation that was so deep that it's still in there, and it's not easy to really approach it.
Which lands us in the realm of beliefs, right? Those mm-hmm. the beliefs about who that original identity was that gets so deeply embedded, and they're still coming up, right? You and I are working with men, 35-year-old, 45-year-old, 55-year-old men who their deepest held belief about themselves is somehow that they're a piece of shit.
Yeah. And they'll say it out loud sometimes, just like that.
How do we reconcile? So this is the work, right? So how do we start to reconcile with those?
Well, there are different techniques that I'll use. So for example, the starting point is if I'm in a coaching session and I've asked the client to share some photos, I'll put the photo up on the screen and share it with him. And then we'll talk about it. I'll ask him questions, you know, like I said, do you feel like this is you? And then we'll explore that. And then I'll ask questions like, well, what does he think of you? Is he proud of you? Is he disappointed in you? Did you let him down? Does he trust you? What do you think of him? Do you trust him? If he could come into the room right now, would he even want to? Because I've had men tell me, no, he doesn't want to come in here, and I don't want him in here. If they're willing to let him in, you know, where in the room would he want to sit? Would he be interested in what we're talking about? Is there something he'd want to contribute? You know, it's just a way to sort of like try to establish, and you have to use your imagination a little bit, that's okay, to try to establish some kind of communication. And another thing I like to do is, you know, and this is true with younger ages too, all of this stuff I'm saying is true. It seems like most typically when people are doing inner child work, so to speak, there's a letter writing thing that people often do. Right. Write a letter to your inner child. It's like, well, pretend you're your inner child, write to the adult. Pretend you're the 13 or 14 or 15-year-old and write to yourself as an adult. Because I maintain that those earlier aspects of us, those younger aspects, have information that we need right now. But they don't necessarily think there's a way to communicate it to us except by subterfuge. So some of the things that you might find yourself doing, you're like, why do I keep doing this? Why do I have to have that giant bag of potato chips right after work? You know, it's like, who are you satisfying with this? Those are all ways to start to develop kind of a sense of communication, a dialogue, to find out, what does this guy want? You know, what is this 12, 13, 14, 15-year-old version of me want from me? Because now I'm the adult. So whatever he didn't get from the adults at the time, that's not going to get fixed. Right now I'm the adult. And this is one of the things that kind of wraps back to what I was saying about myself last year. Yeah. It's like I had to like bring my adult online, and I still need to more often, because certain types of situations would throw me back into, for example, the high school boy who didn't have a girlfriend and dreamed about what it would be like to have one. And so he's just waiting and waiting and waiting. And then if somebody shows up and it seems like, oh, that's her, you know, here comes that 16-year-old, just take it over. And adult me is just going, okay, well, I guess he knows what he's doing, you know, which really isn't safe.
Yeah, terrifying, actually.
Yeah.
That's a great perspective shift for me. Who's coming online in this situation of an unmet need or a perceived unmet need?
Right. Because you have children, you've been around children, you know what kids are like in middle school and all that kind of stuff. It's like they make their mind up that like something's important to them. And just because you get older and you never got it, it doesn't make that desire go away. the desire or the promise. Like, I made promises to myself when I was growing up about what life was going to be when I was an adult. So when I check in with maybe, maybe my 15-year-old self, it's like, well, how do you think I'm doing? He's like, man, you're a sellout, you know?
So,
they're still in there, and they're punching buttons and they're pulling levers, and they're like the Wizard of Oz, you know, like they're in there and they're driving all kinds of decisions. We age regress all the time. I do. I'll speak for myself, but I mean, I age regress all the time during the day. And that's one of the things I work with clients on. It's like when you're feeling upset, if you're feeling disappointed, if you're feeling, like you want to do something impulsively. And you can always ask yourself, how old am I right now? And most of the time, it's not going to be your chronological age.
Phew. In my men's group this week, was processing something, and without going into a huge lot of story, that age is like the 13-year-old me. And it came clear to me, one of the things that my father used to say to me is, you know, if you don't wipe that smirk off your face, I'm going to wipe it off for you.
Oh, yeah. Me too.
And how that kid, that smirky, patronizing, you know, manipulative, arrogant little kid still shows up today in my marriage when I'm not getting what I want.
Right.
And
right.
Yeah.
It's right. Just, so I would encourage, if this was a coaching situation, I would encourage you to develop your dialogue with him and find out what's going on for him. And what is it about an interaction with your wife that causes you to recede back to that age, because something's happening inside you, I would contend.
Yeah.
There's a decision made inside you that, like, that's the guy to handle this situation, right? So your adult abdicates, not necessarily by choice, maybe by default, maybe he feels stress, you know, but there's some decision made in there of like, okay, send in that guy. That this situation requires that 13-year-old.
Yeah. Send in that guy. And what I'm coming to learn about that guy is that guy didn't know how to express preferences, wants, desires, didn't feel like he could speak up for himself, didn't feel like his needs mattered. And the smirky 13-year-old, I could get a reaction out of people, right? It became a way of getting things to move.
There's some power there.
Yeah.
Right? You access some power.
Yeah. But now, like, not useful. Not useful on a Sunday afternoon when we're prepping food and trying to get things done. So,
Worst situation, sorry to interrupt, but I was just going to say the worst situation of all is when you age regress and it causes her to age regress at the same time. And then it's just like, you really should just walk away from each other until you like restore yourself at least to 2/3 of an adult. Because then it's just trauma patterns that are acting, you know, interacting with each other.
And I just shout to my wife, right? We're 20 years in to this thing. And our relationship started with, I did the New Warrior Training adventure in April of 2004, about 6 months after we met. She did a thing called Women in Power the same summer. So shadow work based, bioenergetics. And then we sat in group. I sat in men's group. She sat in women's group for years. So like getting our gears together on doing shadow work together. So today, like, it just makes me laugh. Like when that 13-year-old shows up and then, you know, her 10-year-old shows up.
Right.
It used to be hard, but today it's like, we know each other so well. We see each other so well. It's like, oh, let's dance. There's a shadow dance that we can actually engage in that, yeah, just shout out to my wife and big gratitude.
Well, I think you made an important point there too, which is that when we talk about kind of wrapping back to the beginning, when we talk about your level of maturity as a man, you're always going to have some of those younger selves poking up in certain situations. Unless you are some sort of ascended master who can resolve all of that stuff in one lifetime. So the whole maturity idea is not to reach an end point. As we said, it's a developmental process that's ongoing. It's like trying to, you know, it's like trying to get to this horizon to get to the sun. It's like you're never going to get there. But along the way, you become more of who you really are, were meant to be.
Thank you. I want to start to shift us over a little bit. And one of the things that I may have breezed through too quickly in your bio is that you are a writer and a poet. And that's how we first got introduced, yeah, was the Mankind Project Journal. And you were contributing some works way back when. So we're going to go into a conversation, I think, about the mother wound. And I'm wondering if you would like to open up this section by reading something. So now we're going to go into something that you and I touched on before. And if you've been listening to the podcast in the last few weeks, you know that I did a two-parter with Douglas Gillette, where we talked about the mother complex. And that's something that Rick and I also discussed. So Rick, why don't you read us a poem and then let's dive in.
Sure thing. I've got one sitting right here. This poem is called Mother Space. She octopus of love, I can still feel your soft tentacles wrapped up tight around my heart and lungs, squeezing out blood and oxygen across the years and miles to soothe your timeless wounds. I am your baby boy hologram, created to give you purpose and make you feel worthwhile. I am your life preserver, born wide-eyed and innocent into your world of choppy seas and sinking ships. I am your personal relic, frozen in time and space, thawed and refrozen as required to satisfy your needs. You taught me to keep myself small, to be the best listener, to put my needs last, to sacrifice myself, to wait my turn forever, to be ashamed of myself, to swallow every tear. You taught me to defer to the feminine, to accept the blame, to hide my power, to keep quiet, to keep the peace. You taught me that a man should be harder on himself than he is on anyone else. You taught me that it's better to get sick than to speak up. You taught me how to listen to lies and how to be replaced when the next shiny star caught the wandering eyes of the one I adored. You are the Minotaur's mate in the center of the maze. Your words and your actions live in parallel universes. Your skin reflects my every weakness back at me. You caress me with one hand and hold my head underwater with the other. You come for me time after time in various ways, in various forms. Every woman who enters my life is you, or becomes you, a young girl who doesn't know better, or an old woman who doesn't want to. You can't see me, and you don't know me, but you won't admit it, and you won't let me go. Would it kill you to set me free? Would it kill you if I free myself?
So I think maybe a first place to start then is, how do you define what we're talking about?
That is the best place to start, I think. And I'm going to share a definition that I used in an article that I wrote a few years ago on Huffington Post and elsewhere called Men and the Mother Wound. And the way I started that article is by saying, a mother wound may be thought of as an injury to the psyche of a child resulting from significant dysfunction or disruption in relationship with the mother. In some cases, it is the result of a mother's absence or unavailability due to death, illness, adoption, or other circumstances that dramatically separate the child from the mother. but more typically a mother wound is a complex of injuries to the child's psyche received over many years, often as a result of the mother acting consciously or not out of her own woundedness. One of the most severe kinds of psychic wounding occurs when the child's primary function in the relationship is to be used by the mother to meet her own narcissistic needs.
Well, that's easy and breezy and light, isn't it?
Yes, yeah, it's a little thick. But it's the best way I know how to put it in the way that I've learned about myself and working with other men. And I just have to say that this is one of the most taboo topics that a man can get into. We are not supposed to acknowledge that our mothers didn't do everything that we needed.
And there's a way in which they did not do everything we needed and they did everything they could with what they had, right? There's like, mm-hmm. How can we hold both? How can we hold the paradox of our parents, both of our parents? In this case, we're talking about the mother, right?
Right.
The paradox of some of the most painful things that I experienced as a little kid came from there. And some of the most beautiful pieces of who I am also came from there.
That is a big challenge. That's a big challenge. And I, early on in my work, cause I started with the father wound because my father was so outrageously horrible to be with that he was easy. And it's, I think in general for men, it's easier to kind of take on their fathers first because I don't think men feel so protective about their fathers. We tend to feel protective about our mothers. That's part of what we're supposed to do is protect women and our mothers in particular. Like I said, it was easy to start with my father. Getting around to the issue with my mother took longer. But one of the things I used to hear a lot from people was, well, they did the best they could. It's like, yeah, I know. They did the best they could and they hurt me. And so it is both. I recognize both. If you just stay on one side or the other, you're not going to get any kind of resolution. You do have to get to the point, and I don't mean, again, it's not flipping a switch.
Right.
It's a progressive sort of experience where you learn, I had to learn, others had to learn, to hold both of those at the same time.
Yes.
And it's not the fairy tale version, and it's also not the horror story version for most of us. It's both. And one of the things that I had to do with my father, which I had to do with my mother, which took longer, was begin to see them as independent human beings, not just my parents. And that is something that takes some work for most of us. There's a lot of reconceptualization involved. And again, it goes back to another thing we talked about earlier. It's like, if you want to be a mature man, if you want to be fully an adult, you have to learn to see your parents as something other than your parents.
Yeah.
If not, you're still stuck in a childhood wish.
Say that again.
I said, if not, if you cannot reach the point where you see your parents as something other than your parents, then you are stuck. You are trapped in a childhood wish.
So for men that you work with, what does this look like to practice getting into this? Yeah.
Well, part of it is actually finding ways to characterize your experience with either parent, but we'll just talk about the mother at this point, in terms of your real-time experience as an adult. So one of the things I observed in my case was I would call my mother. I would sit there and clench my jaw for 45 minutes. If I tried to talk about things that mattered to me, she would divert me over to things that mattered to her, and I would feel like shit for 3 days afterwards. Hmm. So, you know, the first step, I think, is to begin to notice how your interactions with her affect you, assuming she's still alive. Because some men, you know, you get up there and they're not around anymore, but you can still reflect upon what your experience was like. You know, do I feel good after I have an interaction with her, or do I feel bad? Does it disrupt my ability to have a good relationship with myself? Do I feel like a phony? Do I feel like a fraud? Do I want to scream at her, but I just keep my mouth shut? Like, these are all indications that your perception and your desire for this person is out of whack with the reality of your experience with that person, who they are. And that's not something that most of us want to sustain if we're trying to live authentically, if we're trying to operate with integrity, if we're trying to be true to ourselves, but we make an exception for one person for an hour a week. That's a sign that you're going to get stuck. So a lot of it initially is just sort of like appraising and evaluating the situation. I have some material that I use to help men determine if their mother's behavior was narcissistic. And if so, what's the level of impact on their life right now? And that just gives us kind of a way to quantify it in kind of a soft way, but at least get a baseline and go, what are the problem areas? Because a lot of the time men, when they come to me, they know, they can tell me all the bad experiences that they're having with their mother and what it feels like and all that kind of stuff, but they're still not quite, there's a gap there between what they know they're experiencing and what they're actually willing to acknowledge as the reality that isn't going to change with that person.
Yeah. And that's great that you came to acknowledging the reality of what's not going to change, because that's the place where we can start to take responsibility for what's in front of us, right?
Yeah, I mean, and that's a big part of it, Boyson. It's like we have to, and this is not about trying to like cause people to victim blame themselves or anything like that. It's just like we have to see our role, and we have to be willing to be accountable for our role. So, you know, in my case, part of the problem was I wanted my mother to be somebody she's not, that she never was and she never will be. And one of the benefits of doing the mother wound work and doing and there's a lot of grieving involved here, just a ton of it. But having gone through that wrenching process and actually separating myself from her psychologically, because I was very enmeshed with her and I didn't know it.
Right.
Is I actually, by allowing her to be who she was, it enabled me to see that I was trying to do to her what I felt like she was trying to do to me, which is like she would not let me be who I was. And it became intolerable for me. And then I had to do a lot of deep work, because again, we're talking about those earlier parts of ourselves that wanted something they're never going to get. And they really, really want it. And so that's where the grief comes up. It's like you have to acknowledge, I'm never, ever going to have that mother I wanted. I'll never have the mother I wanted. Right. Never, ever, ever. And it can't just be here. It's got to be all the way down, inside and out. But having done that, I could actually look at it and go, man, I was wrong. I wasn't wrong. Right. The needs aren't wrong. The original needs are not wrong. Right. But for me to carry it forward into adulthood and continue to insist that she should be the person I want her to be is not ethical. And I don't feel guilty about it. It's just like, I realized that both parties were trying to do the same thing to each other. But I had to get out of the enmeshment in order to see that.
That's beautiful. Jungian, right? Those things that we despise in others are those things that we must face about ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Shadow work.
Yep. Shadow work, right? How I enact the same behaviors that I despise in different ways or in other ways. And then reality always wins. So if I'm forcing expectations onto reality, forcing what I want somebody to be, what I want my mother to be, what I wanted my mother to be, onto someone who is not that.
Right. Right.
Then it's my responsibility to deal with the pain that results from that.
Right. And that, and again, therein lies, in my eyes, the ethical problem.
Yes.
Which is, and also it's a personal problem because I don't want anybody doing that to me.
Right. Yeah. Trying to force me to be something that I am not.
Yeah.
And yeah. Powerful stuff. So if my mom passed away in 2002.
Oh, so it's been a little while.
It's been a long time.
Yeah.
I did work in men's groups in 2005 after going through the New Warrior Training Adventure. I did a piece of separation work from my mother that had a profound impact on me. So I guess that, what do you offer in terms of, so for some of us who are older, our moms have passed away.
Right.
The living being is no longer here, but the patterning is all the same.
Yes.
How do we work with that?
Well, regardless of whether your parent, either parent or other people, are still alive or not, there's an external person there, this flesh and blood, and then there's the internal version that we create.
Yes.
So even after your mother has passed, and even honestly, boys, even when people are alive, a lot of the time we're dealing with the internal version when they're right in front of us, and we don't even realize it.
Here, here.
Yes. It's almost like the internal version supersedes what's on the outside after a certain point. And so in your case, or in the case of a man whose mother has passed, that's where I would want to put the focus, is like, how can we externalize that internal version that you carry around? So again, that could be a different terms of writing exercises. Some guys like to write poetry. I do a lot of artwork with people. I ask them to draw things. So for example, one way to externalize that internalized mother that you were left with is if I said, okay, between now and the next time we talk, draw a picture of how you felt around your mother as an adult when she was still alive. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes what comes through is not an adult version of that experience, but a child's version of that experience. Because number one, when you draw, you bypass your verbal filters, so you don't have all the stuff you're used to. And most people, you know, stop drawing and doing things at about 6 or 7 or 8 years old, and they didn't develop those skills. And so clients will often tell me, well, if I do that, it'll look like a 6-year-old did it. And I'm like, that's perfect.
Perfect.
And then I would ask you, tell me what you wanted me to see. Tell me what you had in mind when you drew this. And then we'll kick that around a little bit. And then I'll tell you, okay, in addition to that, I see this and this and this. Because information makes its way out without your intention when you use a different mode of expression like that. So that's an example of like, how do you externalize the internal mother that you're stuck with? It's like, there's a lot of things we can do. But that's a good one. Because you think it's about your mother, but it's really about the relationship.
Yes.
It's the relationship that's the problem.
Yes.
You know, that's the thing you have to resolve. And that's something I just learned like a year ago in that last, the year of hell that I had last year.
Yeah.
I really started to understand. It's like, there's me and there's somebody else. And then there's this third thing. And when things don't work out, it's my business is not so much with the other person. My business is with that third thing that we co-created that I'm left with.
Co-created that I'm left with, and what I am left with also is not real. It's a story about.
Yes, yes, yes. I had to do a lot of narrative revision last year.
Talk about narrative revision, because I am so hot about that. So talk about narrative revision.
Well, for example, there were things going on in both those relationships that I didn't know about, that I didn't understand. So with a lack of information, I created a narrative that I carried with me about this is what this relationship is like. This is what I can expect. This is what I'm expected to give. This is the outcome. And so much of grieving relationships is not grieving the past. It's grieving what you thought you were going to get,
yes,
what you hoped you were going to get. And part of the narrative is these are my wishes for this relationship. So, and that's what causes so much of the pain. And so I took on the process of examining my thoughts. So when I noticed myself taking a walk and just going, rah, 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 you know, for the 300th time, I'd say, well, wait a minute, I have new information. Is that accurate? It's like, no. It's like, okay, what's accurate? You know, and just do some replacement of some narrative replacement with like, okay, based on what I know now, this is what was going on. This is what was really going on.
Right.
And then, of course, there's a lot of, especially if strong feelings involved, it's like, there's some demonization that I want to fall into of the other person.
Right.
It's like, okay, let me break that down and go, okay, what's the basis for that? Well, they disappointed me. Well, are they obligated to give you what you wanted? No. So yeah, it's, but that's why it takes a year. Because if you've been in a relationship with somebody for some time, you've built up a lot of that stuff. And again, it's about deconstructing the fantasies and the wishes that you had. You think it's for the person, but it's for the relationship.
Right. Right. Which we then embed, which I then embed as, because this is the story I made up about the relationship, then this is what must be true about me as a result.
That's very important too. And that's one of the main reasons to do it. Because you can easily fall into some assumptions about yourself that are hurtful, that are shaming, and yeah, they age regress you back to the point where, yes, there's a part of you inside. Well, I'll just speak for myself. There's a part of me inside when somebody treats me badly because of my experience growing up. There's a part of me inside that wants to go, see, that's what you can expect from everybody.
Right. Right.
Because sometimes that feels safer than the unknown of somebody might treat me badly or they might treat me well. For me, there's a certain part of me that learned this, like it's better for me if I just assume the worst. And then when it happens, it's just like, okay.
See?
I knew that was going to happen.
Yeah, exactly. I knew it was going to happen, right? The misery that we are in is more comfortable than the unknown. Facing the unknown.
Well, and that's where some of the, again, I keep wrapping back around to different earlier things, but like that's why one reason why it's so important to develop some sort of active relationship with your younger selves, because my 6-year-old is still very optimistic. My 15-year-old is very cynical. And so like in certain situations, one or the other is going to rise up and take the lead. And one of the reasons the 15-year-old is so cynical is because he wants to protect the 6-year-old. That's the other thing I realized. It's like your older, let's say your adolescent, pre-adolescent self, he tends to feel responsible it's like a little brother that he wants to protect. So a lot of my cynicism arose out of a recognition that I have to protect my more sensitive, my more tender, my naive innocent, which goes with a younger age. So. Believe me, man, I've spent a lot of time with these guys.
That's wonderful.
I'll tell you real quick. Like I had an experience. I was driving to the airport to pick somebody up a couple of years ago. I was very nervous. And I was kind of getting anxious and panicky and stuff. And I just had this idea. I said, okay, everybody, in my mind's eye, I could see a round table, like the Knights of the Round Table. And I said, everybody of every age, come to the table right now. And so I'm driving to the airport and I'm kind of imagining this thing in my mind. And I said, okay, we're all in this together. We're going to get this done. If anybody starts to wander away from the table, somebody go get him. If it's a little one wanders away, big one, go get him. If it's a big one wanders away, little one, go get him. Tell him, come back here. And it settled me down. And then I wasn't so scared anymore. So what does that say? Well, we're fragmented. At least, you know, I am. Like, and if we can defragment and bring ourselves together, we feel a little bit more like we can handle things.
Bring ourselves together with the image that you just created that has even richer meaning, right? Ourselves, all of the ourselves.
Yes.
Bring all of ourselves to the table to sit down.
Yeah.
Something else that I just want to throw in as we're wrapping up is the other, you know, a couple more wonderful aspects is that, you know, my 5-year-old or my 6-year-old or my 13-year-old, they're all highly unreliable witnesses also.
Oh boy, you got a good one going there. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah. Right? Like my version of reality from that perspective was highly colored. And also it's been rewritten in my nervous system over and over and over and over since that time. So that when I look back on that now, if there's anything that I, if there's any fixed point, right? If there's any canon event that I am speaking to, it's just the version that I have reinforced and made up.
Mm-hmm.
And again,
but again, I think we're talking about another one of those balance points, like where you have to be able to understand that your ability to perceive and reason and make sense of when you're 5 years old is not developed to the point of an adult.
Right.
That doesn't mean that it doesn't matter. That doesn't mean that it's all made up. That doesn't mean that there's nothing there of value. And it doesn't mean that his viewpoint doesn't matter.
Right. So it just more puts the emphasis on the responsibility, whose responsibility it is now. Right.
Right.
For me, it's like all of it is my responsibility. The emotional weight of early as an adult, the emotional weight of an early childhood experience is real and has had an impact.
Right.
And as an adult, it's my responsibility.
Right.
To care for it.
You're right. You have to fill in for the adult, for the not good enough parent who, for whatever reason, didn't recognize, didn't understand, wasn't capable, didn't want to, was distracted, all those kind of things. And that's where, you know, a lot of the time I've over the years, I've heard people say, well, you know, you're just whining, you know, why don't you just get over it? And it's just like, I am getting over it. You know, like I'm getting over it by dealing with it. And it is an iterative, incremental developmental process. I mean, there are, you know, we talked beforehand briefly. My first poetry book came out in 1990, and I look at it now and I'm proud of it and I'm glad that I did it. And I think it's incredible work for, I was like 31 years old. Mm-hmm. But I wouldn't write that book now, because I, you know, my narrative has changed and my characterization of things has changed. But I knew when I was writing that book, it's like, this is a right now book. This isn't something that I would expect to write in 20 years or 30 years or whatever. It was, this is how I see it right now. And if I still saw things the way I did then, right now, then I would not have made much progress. But that was great progress at the time.
I think that you just invented something for me, which I'm going to take away from this interview, which is, this is the right now me.
Yes.
This is the right now me.
Yeah.
Judging the right now me by someone else's standards or some future me standards or some past me standards is just unfair and causing, it's just hurtful to me.
Yeah.
So I think I'll just stick with the right now me and acknowledge all the ways that I have.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
This is one of the things I've had to learn. You know, I used to be, I remember one time I was in a men's group and I was probably 35 or something like that. So it was like 30 years ago. And I don't know what I'd been carrying out about. And the facilitators said, "But you seem to be very relentless with yourself." And I said, "What are you talking about? I'm just trying to get things done." It felt so, you know, I'm sure you've had those moments too, where somebody, well, they see you clearly and they say it and you're like, "What are you talking about?" And it took me years to begin to understand and see what he saw, that like, yeah, I still can be, not nearly as much, but I was absolutely relentless with myself. I just wouldn't give myself a break. Nothing was good enough. I over-engineered everything. I over-functioned all over the place. And I know why. I know why I did those things. I understand why now. But that's part of, again, it's part of the work I try to do with all of my clients, male or female, is like to help you see the parts of yourself that you're just blind to, which is nothing to be ashamed of. A lot of the time we learned and we were taught not to see those parts of ourselves. And it was critical to our survival that we stopped seeing them.
Yes. Rick Belden, what a rich discussion. There's probably more.
Oh, yeah.
Do you want to close with, would it make sense to close with the other poem that you're sitting on?
Yes. I'm going to choose the other one that we talked about, which is about one of the things we just touched on is the importance of, and particularly for men, and particularly if you want to be a mature man, you have to be able to deal with your grief. You have to be able to recognize it and access it and express it. And it's hard for a lot of us. It's still hard for me. I cried more last year than I probably cried in the preceding 50 years of my life. And it's still hard. And there are reasons for that we could talk about another time if you like. But I'd like to read a poem I wrote about probably about 10 years ago about the challenge and the experience of holding on to that stuff because you don't know what else to do with it.
Thank you.
So let me pull that one up. This is a shorter one too. Okay. This one is called Tears Never Cried. What happens to all the tears I never cried? Where did they go? Have I transformed them into something else? Absorbed them into my body somehow? Or have I been saving them up somewhere in some secret place, unseen and unknown, deep within myself? Are they gone for good? Are they forever hidden? Or are they simply waiting? Maybe waiting for me to finally feel safe enough to allow myself their presence and their companionship in my everyday life. Maybe waiting for an opening to move through me all at once in a rush, transforming my life and my being in one radiant moment, like an invasion of angels, or maybe waiting to come to me in wave after wave when I'm on my deathbed, too old for shame, too weak to fight, and too tired to hold them back anymore.
Thank you. Thank you. Rick, where should our listeners find more about you and your work?
My sort of legacy website is rickbelden.com. That gives you access to everything, writing, poetry, podcasts, YouTube channel, all that kind of stuff. If people are interested in contacting me about coaching, that site is rickbeldencoaching.com. And I offer a free 30-minute discovery session if somebody would like to talk to me and find out if what I do is a good fit for what they need.
Look for the links in the show notes, everyone. Thank you so much for being here. Rick, thank you for having this conversation. I've really enjoyed it.
Me too, boys. And we finally got to talk, right? And I love having these conversations. If my wish, which I think is an adult wish, is that men could have more of these conversations on a regular basis, because I think it's really needed.
I agree. Hear, hear. Thank you.
Okay.
This has been the Mankind Podcast, produced in association with the Mankind Project USA. And I personally want to thank our guests for joining us today and imparting their wisdom from their experiences in this amazing journey called life. Now, the fee for this episode is simple. If you found gold and insights that you believe could benefit your loved ones and those you care about, be sure to share it with them. And of course, remember that life doesn't happen to us. It happens for us, so long as we rip the pen out of fate's hand and become the author of our own story. So my friend, pick up the pen, and we'll see you next week. Lots of love.